From the Lynn DeGrint University in Urbana, Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 24th day of June, 2026. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Greg Johnson. We'll hear from weed scientist Aaron Hager and Corteva's Jeff Bode. They were both at the field day on campus earlier today, and we'll turn our attention as we wrap up our time together by taking a look at the weather forecast, too. We'll do that with Drew Lerner of World Weather Incorporated right here on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world, online on demand at WILLAG.org.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
The theme music for the Closing Market Report is written, performed, produced, and courtesy of Logan County, Illinois farmer and my brother, Tim Gleason. Greg Johnson from TGM, that's Total Grain Marketing, right here in Champaign County, now joins us to talk about the marketplace. Hi, Greg. Thanks for being with us again today.
Yeah, very welcome, Todd.
You know, over the last week and a half, maybe 2 weeks, it seems that the market has settled in more of a normal, fundamental summertime cadence, not looking so much to the outside markets. What does that tell you about what the next few weeks might look like?
Well, you're right. We have been following kind of a seasonal pattern here. Once we get the crop planted, and we always get the crop planted, maybe not in ideal conditions, but once we get the crop planted and it gets off to a start, the market tends to sell off because that fear of not getting planted has gone by, and it's still too early to talk about pollination weather. So that interim between 1st of June and 1st of July is typically a downtime for the market, and that's exactly what we're seeing. The funds have really bailed out of commodities. 1st of May, they were long over 3 billion with a B bushels of corn, beans, and wheat, if you combine the three commodities together. Since then, they've sold off that entire amount, 3 billion bushels. So if you can imagine 3 billion bushels of grain being sold in a two-month period, it's no wonder that corn is down 80 cents from the highs that we made in mid-May, and beans are down 90 cents from where we were, and wheat's down 80, 90 cents as well. So we've just had a big sell-off. The funds have bailed out for whatever reason. You know, maybe the Middle East situation is calming down. Maybe, you know, take your pick as far as why. But the fund selling has really been a big a weight on this futures market. And as a result, farmer selling has dried up. Farmers aren't interested in selling at these prices. So we've seen basis improve quite a bit to try to do some of the work of incentivizing farmers to move grain. Corn basis is about a nickel better than where it was 10 days ago. Bean basis is about 10 cents better than it was 10 days ago. But that's a small drop in the bucket compared to the futures drop. So flat price is still a lot lower, and farmer selling is non-existent, basically. And we are waiting for pollination weather to maybe give us a bounce. And the other thing would be the next Tuesday's USDA prospective plantings report, along with the quarterly stocks report. Those two things, the weather around pollination time and the report next Tuesday, probably would be our next big market movers.
Okay, so I have something very funny for you to think about, but some once in a while, oats knows. And oats are off sharply, at least in the lead option, not so much in the deferred months today. However, I was just looking at the chart for them. I believe their contract high in the July is in the week of May 18. Their contract low is this week. So the question is, do oats really know, and do we have more downside? Because today is 18 cents lower in that old crop contract. And maybe it's just that it knows about old crop. I don't know.
Well, and with harvest, at least with wheat harvest coming up, I know wheat tends to make a seasonal low when we're about two-thirds of the way through wheat harvest. And then we tend to see a little bit of a bounce. And so I think the state of Illinois is 40 to 50% harvested statewide. Now, we really haven't even started around here. If the weather would ever dry up and cooperate a little bit, I think we could start seeing some wheat come in. But it looks like there's more rain in the forecast for us later this week. And so wheat harvest in central Illinois may not start until next week, the way it's looking right now. So to answer your question about oats, I guess I can't point to anything positive. So. I wish I could, other than, you know, the demand for corn is still very strong. I mean, we've improved demand from 15 billion bushels a year to up to 16.2. I don't see that demand going down. So if we would have a weather problem, I don't know that the demand is going to go down. So we'd have to have the price go up to ration off that smaller crop. But we don't have a smaller crop yet to talk about.
Well, I think what I was thinking about was the difference between old and new crop and that July contract telling me that, hey, there might be plenty of corn in the elevator still, and that might cause things to have. Do you think there will be a storage issue if we have a normal size crop this year?
I really think it boils down to whether we can export beans to China in the fall, as we typically do. We don't have enough storage space for both corn and soybeans, so something has to move. It would be nice to see the beans move in the fall. I do think we have enough storage space for a normal crop of corn and beans, given the normal export demand that we see in soybeans. But if we do not see the export business, an export bean program in the fall, yes, then storage space could get tight.
Any indication that is about to happen? Do you see anything happening in the marketplace that tells you China is in?
USDA has incorporated that 25 million metric tons that China promises to buy from us every year for the next 3 years. So I guess USDA still thinks that they're good for it. So let's hope that they are.
Indeed. Hey, thanks much. We'll talk with you again next week. Actually, we'll talk with you tomorrow for our Commodity Week program.
All right. Looking forward to it.
Greg Johnson is with TGM. That's TotalGrainMarketing.com. This morning, I was on site at the South Farms for the Weed Science Field Day. I ran into Jeff Bodie. He's a technical agronomist with Corteva. I asked him why it was that he had shown up.
Dr. Aaron Hager and his team do a great job here evaluating different herbicide trials, both corn and soybeans. So just taking a broad look at what is working here, and really get an idea of what insights he is having as the future of weeds progress and seeing what the future can bring.
What do you look at when you come here? What are the things that you have on your priority list?
Yeah, so the big piece with weed management is residual herbicides. So really start to evaluate what different herbicides, what value they're bringing, different tank mixes and weed spectrum differences.
So when you walk around, you look into the competition too to see how that works, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. Like not only competition, but just a vast difference of different AIs that are out here in the marketplace. So seeing how they can manage against the different weed species like a velvet leaf that we see over in that plot or water hemp, that's always a discussion.
AI,
active ingredients. Not the AI that we think about on a daily basis.
Indeed. So as you think about the importance of having weed science programs at Illinois, Iowa State, Purdue, Minnesota, Nebraska, North Dakota State, all of those places, how do they play into the larger, and I'm talking about the land grants, of course, larger agrochemical system?
Yeah, just the research they provide, and it's really that knowledge base that we try to lean on quite a bit at Corteva, just being able to understand what they're seeing locally. You mentioned land grants, the different ones across the different states there, but understanding what they're seeing, the research that they're doing, and helping that from my side, who's in the field every day of the week, to see how we can utilize that information and pass that down to our retail partners and eventually and gets into the growers' hands.
The annual Weed Science Field Day is a one-off event. How often do you talk with weed scientists across the systems?
Multiple times throughout the growing season and really throughout the year, right? Through different meetings that we have or different functions. So I guess the answer would be it's not regular, but it's consistent enough that we have a relationship.
And the importance of this kind of science, this kind of research, the funding behind it, means what to Corteva and the broader farm economy?
There again, it's that being able to have the information here, the research that they're doing, and to be able to pass that along, and which will eventually end up in our growers' hands, which at the end of the day, that's production agriculture that we all support.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That's Jeff Bode with Corteva. We're now joined by Aaron Hager, weed scientist with University of Illinois Extension, faculty member here on campus. He puts together a good portion of this program. Aaron, you have a good turnout here today. When you are bringing in folks like Jeff Bode from Corteva, and farmers for that matter, what are your hopes that they will go away with? And I suspect it's different for the two audiences.
It really can be, Todd. You know, when I started here at Illinois 33 years ago, the wheat science tour was not actually open to the public. Back then, we had a lot of companies who were still synthesizing new herbicide molecules. It wasn't uncommon. We may have anywhere from 2 to 5 brand new active ingredients every year. So back in the day then, it was pretty much restricted to just the companies, the manufacturers who were bringing these new AIs to us to evaluate in the field. But probably, I don't remember now for sure, maybe 15 years or so back, we just made the decision. We see fewer AI or new active ingredients every year, so we just made it. Fewer companies, you know, of course, too, with consolidation. And so we opened this tour up to the general public. So we still get a mix. We have a lot of our company people that come here, a lot of farmers, custom applicators come here. The idea is, you know, we put a sign in front of each treatment of the first replicate, and then we have a tour booklet. If somebody would like to see what the second and third replicates look like, they can use the tour booklet to see which plots those would be in. And sometimes we'll have new AIs that we can actually show on the tour, but sometimes, you know, we do a lot of concept work now also. You know, for example, we started looking about 8 or so years ago, taking a so-called second look at Metribuzin and what Metribuzin can bring for soybean farmers in terms of trying to get water hemp under control from a pre-emergent standpoint. You know, we recognize the fact that based on the work from Dr. Tranel's lab and the survey work that we've done, most of the triazine resistance that we have in our water hemp populations in Illinois, it's not target site based. It's metabolic based, which means atrazine doesn't work, but Metribuzin still does. And we've done rate titrations with this. We actually had funding from the United Soybean Board to do this titration work across about 15 states. And so that's something that we think is still a viable option for a lot of soybean farmers. Really caution them to be successful with it. They have to get the application rate right. But I think that's something, you know, that most farmers, retail applicators, hopefully the industry can look at and try to design some new product concepts around, you know, something like Metribuzin, but certainly to get the rate where it needs to be.
This is a one-off event today. Can producers, retailers, do they contact you to come see it at other times?
Actually, we had a group here that asked if they can bring a group, I believe Friday of this week. I mean, given what the weather conditions are going to be like, it's hard to tell if they'll be able to do that. But yeah, we'll keep the signs up here for several more weeks. If folks, you know, want to come out and take a look at it, they can at their leisure. If they let us know ahead of time, we can try to get them a tour booklet so they can, again, you know, if they see something that they like, if they want to see what the second, third replicate look like, we can get them a tour booklet if they let us know they're coming ahead of time.
I spoke with Aaron Hager earlier today at the Weed Science Field Day. If you'd like to tour the plot, you can set that up with Aaron directly, or you may call me and I'll put you in touch with him. My phone number is at willag.org. Let's turn our attention now to the growing regions across the planet. Drew Lerner is here and is a meteorologist at World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City. Hello, Drew. Thank you for being with us today.
Yeah, I hope everything's good over that way. It certainly is warm and humid here.
We had a beautiful day here. I suppose the humidity's coming our way soon. So it was a very nice morning for the Weed Science Field Day. I do want to start in the fields, but not here in the United States today. Europe, particularly France, has been suffering through a heat wave. Can you tell me about it and how it compares historically and what you think it might mean?
You know, I can certainly attempt to do that. I've been forecasting the weather internationally for about 47 years, I guess it is. And I do not remember a time when France was this hot for this many days in a row. We've seen temperature extremes in France running from 110 to 116 degrees each of the last 3 days. Today's afternoon temperatures were hottest in the interior northwest and also in the interior southwest, where we saw 115 and 113 respectively. And believe it or not, we've got 100 degrees in London today. And now this, in 2019, we had some significant heat wave activity in Western Europe as well. And that did set some records for extreme highs. But I'm wondering here, and I don't have the statistics to prove it, but I'm thinking that this may be one of the longer durations of extreme heat, rather than setting records for the hottest readings on record. I think it's probably going to end up being the longest stretch of extreme heat. But that's something I don't have a good handle on to be able to fully assess for you. But we expect to see hot weather again tomorrow, very similar to today. And then as we go Friday into the weekend, we'll start to cool down the western parts of France and the UK, and eventually that'll shift all across the rest of Europe. In the meantime, Germany will be next on the list for seeing temperatures over 100 in a significant manner tomorrow and Friday, maybe Saturday as well. A lot of heat stress here, as you know. There's not a lot of air conditioning over there for humans, but we're seeing a lot of illness from humans and livestock across the region, a lot of punishment for crops. The vegetative health index for France before this heat wave arrived was not as bad off as it was a year ago, which I found to be kind of interesting. But I am anxious to see what those crops look like in another week to 10 days. We are not expecting to see significant rain fall even after the heat wave backs off. So it's going to be 10 days at least of minimal rainfall, a few showers, but less than a half inch of moisture.
Move into the Black Sea area and the growing regions of Russia.
Yeah, for the Black Sea, everything's been wonderful up to this point. We are now seeing some of this heat from Europe advertised to move into Ukraine and parts of southwestern Russia, Belarus and the Baltic states, even Poland. And so when that happens, we're going to see the soil moisture decline. Right now, the soil moisture situation in that particular part of the world is rated quite favorably. There's a little bit of firming in the topsoil occurring right now, but I think we've got a week to 10 days of drying coming up. And so we'll keep a close eye on that. As long as it rains again in the second or third week of July, I don't think there's going to be any big issue here, but it gives us something else to look at. And at the same time that it's going to dry down there, we are going to see quite a bit of rain continuing in the central two-thirds of the Russian New Lands. Now, that particular area is they produce primarily spring wheat and sunseed in that area. And it looks like they've been wet already most of this month. It has not been excessively wet necessarily until just recently. And it looks like we're going to see a lot more rain over the next week to week and a half, and cool temperatures too. So that's going to probably raise some concern about wet weather disease over there.
In the subcontinent, India, what do the crops look like today?
Well, today, from what I just read a little while ago, it looks like planting is advancing quite favorably across the subcontinent there. But it's not raining, and it looks like we have another week to go before rain occurs. So that means we're going to finish out June way below normal on precipitation. And the last I saw, I think it was yesterday, the country as a whole, nationally speaking, was about 34% below normal rainfall for the month. And I think we'll probably finish the month pretty close to that. Now, July and August are by far more important for rain months. And I fully expect this El Nino to kind of underperform, I guess is the best way to put it. And I'm expecting India to have its first national drought since 2016. 2015 and 2016 were 2 years in which that country ended up with quite a bit less than normal precipitation during the monsoon. And it wasn't as serious in those 2 years as it was in 2010. In 2010, the anomaly was something close to 22%, I believe is what it was. So hopefully we can avoid that. But we do need to watch India closely because I think the potential is fairly high that their agricultural industry may be impacted by this El Nino.
A quick word on the conditions for corn areas in China.
China looks pretty good. I don't think we've got too much to worry about in China. The main corn and soybean areas in the northeast are seeing routinely occurring rainfall, some sunshine as well. I think conditions are looking fairly well there, and I think it'll stay that way. It's a little dry in east central China. That's another corn, soybean, and groundnut production area. It's also where the wheat is grown. And some of that wheat area, of course, the wheat crop is being harvested now, so having dry weather right now is perfect for that purpose. And the outlook is looking pretty good. I do think that region may dry down a little bit additionally as time goes forward. And in far southern China, in their rice and sugarcane areas, there's definitely too much rain there. And the quality of early season rice is probably slipping lower at the moment. It is harvest time for the early season crop, but they have two other crops that they plant, so it's not necessarily a disaster at this point.
Now come back to the United States. I would like to check in on the Central Valley in California first.
Yeah, I think things out there are doing okay. You know, the big concern for California is what happens as we go forward through the next 12 months. We are not expecting to see any excessive heat to occur out that way for any great length of time. Water supply is still good. And we should be able to go through this entire growing season without any big issues for water supply. Now, as we go through the winter, El Nino events do typically produce excessive rains in parts of California. And so if that's the case, we will probably still have a good water supply situation coming into 2027's growing season.
And finally, a word about the middle of the country, particularly the Corn Belt.
Yes, and it looks like South Dakota, western Iowa, northeastern Nebraska, and southwestern Minnesota are going to slip back into a more significant dry bias here for the next 10 days or so. We're not looking at much moisture up that way. And of course, they've been fighting some drier tendencies through much of the growing season so far. So we'll need to watch that area pretty closely. We are expecting to see a high pressure ridge build across the Midwest. That's going to occur next week. And when I say Midwest, I'm talking about the proper Midwest. So it'll be over Indiana, Illinois, Michigan, maybe Ohio. But that ridge will work its way back to the west in the second weekend of the two-week forecast. And that will bring heat into South Dakota, Iowa, and Minnesota, making that drier bias there all the more significant. So that would be the area to watch. The rest of the Midwest will probably benefit from the heat and dryness for a short period of time. The ridge will shift to the west, like I said, and that'll open the door for cooler air and more showers and thunderstorms by the second week of July.
Hey, thank you much. I appreciate it.
You bet. Have a great day.
You too. Drew Lerner is with World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City and helped us to wrap up this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media, online on demand at WILLAG.org. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason.